This is Treasury Matters, the podcast from Alma. Each week through this series, we will be joined by a leading industry voice to talk all things Treasury. Today's guest is trading consultant Patricia White, who specialises in Treasury risk and in particular around the transition to net zero.
Welcome, Patricia White, to Treasury Matters. Fantastic to have you on the podcast and nice to see you.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here and support this new initiative from ALMA.
Now, Patricia is the course leader of ALMA's Foundations of ILM Open Course. She also leads our climate change course and, in addition, sometimes provides in-house courses to particular banks or other building societies within the ALMA program. So we're delighted to have her here. But Patricia isn't just a course leader. She's worked in many organizations, including banks and in the treasury departments of those organizations. But Patricia, before we go into the heart of the treasury aspects of these things, can you tell me a bit of your background? How did you get into finance? What's your sort of CV? And how did that finish up with you getting involved in treasury type stuff and ALMA type stuff?
Sure. I guess when I was at school, I was interested in economics. And maybe that interest came from listening to my mother when we went shopping when I was a kid, moaning about, you know, the price of this and the price of that, given that I was going shopping with my mother in the 70s when there were, you know, significant bouts of inflation, not too dissimilar from what we've just lived through here, perhaps. So maybe that's where my interest in economics came from, demand and supply and all that. But in any event, I did pursue economics at university and combined it with statistics and econometrics. And econometrics is basically a big word for applying, doing statistical analysis of economic issues, questions. So I was quite interested in economic forecasting. So long short, I wanted either to go to work at the Bank of England or the Treasury to do macroeconomic forecasting, because that's what I was interested in. And ended up at the Bank of England, mainly because there's a clear focus on monetary economics there, which I was interested in. And so I got into a team which was responsible for international economic forecasting. So basically providing the world economic forecast that was a context for the UK forecast that the bank produces. And so that was super interesting. My first introduction to the world of work. But what I quickly discovered was that doing economic forecasting in the real world is a lot more complicated and very different than doing it in an academic kind of context, or at least that I'd done to that point. So I was involved for a couple of years and then basically decided that wasn't how I wanted to spend the rest of my life. But had the opportunity, of course, at the Bank of England, having joined on the graduate scheme, to be able to rotate into a number of different roles across the bank. So I was in the markets area. I was in the wholesale supervision side, looking at the gilt edge market makers. And I ended up on the banking supervisory policy side of things, very much focused on the trading book, the introduction of the Basel market risk amendment, which allowed for the first time banks to use their internal risk models, their value at risk models, to calculate regulatory capital. We sometimes forget now, I think, that actually internal model calculations of capital started with market risk and only later moved on into the credit risk space. So I was quite involved with that and also with the on-site review teams, which was the very beginning of supervisors and technical specialists going out to firms to review their risk management and governance processes. That was the very beginning of that. So that was pretty interesting. But I have to say that I had a fantastic oversight of what's going on across the city, what's going on across the industry, which I probably didn't appreciate really at the time, only with hindsight. But there's always that thing, you're sitting in the stands and maybe you actually want to be on the pitch playing the game. So I left the bank and went to join PwC, PricewaterhouseCoopers. Actually, it was just Coopers and Lybrand at the point that I joined. And I joined the management consultancy side, the financial risk management practice. And I spent 3 years living out of a suitcase pretty much across continental Europe, working with some pretty interesting firms around their risk management framework and their governance frameworks primarily, mostly on the market risk side, a bit on the credit risk side. Some of it sort of remedial response to regulatory pressure, and others more aspirational, just wanting to improve themselves. But I did that, lived out of a suitcase for 3 years. The novelty kind of wore off, and I still wanted to get on the pitch and play the game rather than just be sort of on the sidelines. So at that point, I joined Abbey National, which very quickly became Santander. And that was really my route into banking. I joined on the market risk side. But after a couple of years and after the Santander acquisition, ended up on the non-traded market risk side, so interest rate risk in the banking book, so to say. So that really was my route into the treasury world, and I have to say I was dragged screaming and kicking into it, if I'm honest. My boss at the time said, would I like to take this opportunity on the non-traded side? And I thought, hell no. All the funky stuff is going on the trading side. That's where it's all about. It's where all the modeling is. It's where all the smart quanty people are. That's where I want to be. But I think at the third time of asking, it became clear that he wasn't asking whether I wanted to go or not. I was going. So that's what I did. And honestly, I've never looked back. Wouldn't have missed it for the world. So that's how I got there.
Fantastic. And just you mentioned the market risk amendment. People get quite confused. If I recall correctly, was the market risk amendment about sort of 1996 when people talk about Basel I? Basel kind of didn't do market risk at first. It was only credit risk that can be the only thing in banks. Was that we talk about 1988 or something approximately that time. And then they decided market risk was a thing in about 1996. Is that about the timetable?
Yeah, no, absolutely right. Well remembered. The Basel Market Risk Amendment, which introduced Pillar One, as we now say, capital requirements for trading book market risk, so FX interest rate, equity risk, commodity price risk, came in. Well, Basel came in 90, or published in 96, and then of course the European Union transposed the Basel Amendment into the second Capital Adequacy Directive, CAD 2. So yeah, that it was the policy, the Bank of England's policy around that we were working on. But to your point that in 88, Basel I, as we now call it, dealt only with credit risk and in a very simple kind of way. But I do believe that there was simultaneously always an intention to look at interest rate risk at least. And I think when Basel started looking at, if we can say, market risk, they actually had in mind producing a standard not just for trading book, but also for what we'd now call interest rate risk in the banking book. But gave up because it was all a bit too hard. And as we now know, it took until, gosh, 2016, is it 2016 when the latest IRBB standards came out of Basel?
You also mentioned about sort of risk management frameworks and governance. And I always like to ask that question to lots of people that we band around this term governance. So, and you'll sit inside of a treasurer and someone will say, this hasn't been through governance. What does governance, and probably better question is, what does good governance really mean to you, Patricia?
Yeah, governance is one of those words, isn't it? And maybe it's a little bit like culture as well, which is again maybe like an elephant. You know it when you see it. Governance to me is, or good governance to me is about socializing important decisions and making sure that the right people have been consulted or advised or signed it off. And when we're working in a treasury function or any other function within a bank or building society, we can think we've got the most fantastic solution in the world, but actually we're not going to implement that proposal or that solution in isolation of the rest of the bank. There are always a lot of other stakeholders who have to be consulted, engaged, have their input, and ultimately it needs to be signed off by grown up. So good governance, I think, kind of keeps you safe. As as an individual, you don't want the whole weight of the decision necessarily sitting on you when actually it's sort of bigger than you are. So good governance should be your friend, I would suggest.
You mentioned that you started in the market risk space. And, when anyone says market risk to me, I'm thinking fair value through P&L. I'm thinking trading types, people on phones that you see when you see the news talk about the city, that type of thing. But you moved into the sort of other side of market risks. Arguably, the much bigger market risks in the bank are actually taken in the interest rate risks in the banking book side of the world. So, what's your view on interest rate risk in the banking book over the last few years? You mentioned that, not a lot happened sort of from a regulatory perspective for a long time, and maybe it didn't need to happen from a regulatory perspective. I mean, interest rates only ever went down, didn't they? I mean, that's the idea since for 40 years, interest rates only sort of crept down slowly. But given what's happened in the last couple of years, when you've been looking from the outside a little bit from the interest rate side, what would be your take on how you see things?
I think that we used to know a lot about interest rate risk in the banking book in the years leading up to the global financial crisis, which began in 2007. Because, as you say, interest rates moved. And then interest rates, at least in the West, were cut to close to zero, negative in the Eurozone, and stayed there pretty much for about, I don't know, 10 or 15 years. And we, as an industry, I think, sort of forgot a little bit about interest rate risk in the banking book. An awful lot of the focus was on, inevitably, and probably rightly, was on liquidity risk, funding risk, and making sure that the crisis would never happen again. And I think, my observation from the outside of no particular firm at all, but just the industry, was that it's a pity that we sort of had to relearn some of the stuff that we knew back then all over again in the last couple of years, and sometimes in a slightly painful way. And I guess it's inevitable. You have a focus on a particular topic, and then something else supersedes it, and you just don't get the resources, you don't get the management focus. You're not getting the questions from top of the shop that kind of keeps you on your toes with your models and your analysis and so on. And it sort of gets a little bit dusty. So I think it's unfortunate. Hopefully, the last couple of years, it's certainly my impression that, there now are a lot more resources and a lot more management focus being applied to interest rate risk. And that, that's only good. Because as you say, it is a very big risk for all firms.
And probably a little unfairly, but there's been a lot of talk about structural hedging over the last couple of years, and how maybe some firms have put on structural hedges that are a lot out of the money relatively. Are you a believer in structural hedging, or how do you think about structural hedging?
I'm a believer. I think that structural hedging is much more about hedging against rate falls, falling and very low rates, than it is about, what's happening if interest rates are going up. Why? Because when interest rates are falling and low, you haven't got as many other levers in the business that you can pull to manage net interest income and net interest margin. You've just got less wiggle room. If rates are kind of zero pretty much, then you really don't have very much opportunity to manage margins. And if rates are not moving very much, if the Bank of England isn't moving base rate up or down very much, then there are fewer opportunities to manage margin. Whereas in a high and a rising rate environment, there you just have more room. You have more opportunity to pull other levers to manage your margins. So what we saw when interest rates were cut, very aggressively in 2008 and 2009, was that, all of the major UK firms had been doing structural hedging, and I forget the numbers, but the revenue saved, the net interest income saved through having those structural hedges in place was, frankly, critical to the survival of those firms at the time. A problem with margins collapsing on top of all the other problems that the firms were having to cope with at that time would just have been very unhelpful. So I think structural hedging absolutely did its job then. And I think, as we go into the next rate cutting cycle, it'll do its job again. It's true that there's been a very long period of very low and very stable interest rates, and that has called into question the value of structural hedging. But I think that's slightly missing the point. The idea of structural hedging, ultimately, to me, it's asymmetric. It's to protect against low and falling rates.
And just as an aside, would you say, on the basis that you're protecting that, you shouldn't really worry where the curve is when you do it? Because at the moment, as an example, if you were to structurally hedge currently, you're having to put on a hedge where with an inverted yield curve, which obviously most banks would much prefer to put on a structural hedge when the yield curve is upward sloping, and preferably very heavily upward sloping, you would have thought. Would you just say, well, that is the whole point about structural hedging? You've got to put it on all the time and continue to put it on, and you'll have to take where the curve is? Or do you think you should be a little bit more dynamic around that view?
This is the whole art, the whole fun, I guess, of interest rate risk in the banking book, isn't it? That there is no risk neutral position. If you have equity, which or reserves, then you have a structural risk that you need to manage. There is no risk neutral position. Yeah, in theory, if all firms had continued their structural hedging program unchanged for the last 10 or 15 years, then we would just be on a nice caterpillar, rolling over 1/60th or whatever of the hedge every month. And, all of the firms who were considered themselves competitors or peers would have a, similar sort of evolution of their net interest margins, give or take, at least from the structural hedging component. But obviously, people have not managed it like that over the last 10, 15 years. And so there is a question of, yeah, how do you re-establish it? And yeah, for sure, you want to time that as optimally as you can. Why do it this month if you reckon that you can make 10 basis points more next month? You're not there to lose money. And I think, that's the whole art, the whole fun of interest rate risk in the banking book is judging, when does that cease to be managing the balance sheet? When does that actually become punting the balance sheet, which of course we're not meant to do.
Over the course of the last sort of 20 years, 25 years, that you've probably been watching, or more, that you've been watching banks, do you think they've become investable places for you? There's a lot more rules, a lot more regulation, a lot more constraints around the balance sheet. For you, are these banks actually investable businesses now, or are they really just more like utilities? And maybe that is an investable business. It's just an investable business at a relatively low return. How do you see that, given your experiences over the last few decades?
Well, I suppose the simple answer to that is that I'm not invested in any banks, and I consciously decided not to be. Don't think that banks create shareholder value. So I guess my answer is I'm not sure that they are investable. I mean, as Basel III was introduced, we told ourselves that it would turn the industry into something more like a utility industry, and maybe it has, but I'm not sure that investors perceive that the risk has reduced in the same proportion because banks, as we saw last year with Silicon Valley, Credit Suisse, even with Basel III, banks will always find a way to mess up. Some of them will be new and some of them will just be the same old way of messing up. the risks are still there and there are new risks to come, and it's not obvious that future margins will adequately compensate investors for the risk that they're taking.
Patricia, we've talked there about some of the classic treasury risks that we think about all the time. But over the course of the last couple of years, you've dedicated quite a lot of time to looking at climate change and maybe some of the linkages to treasury departments and banks. And you run a course for ALMA on climate change. Can you talk to us about why you've done that and why you find that interesting and I'm guessing important?
Well, hopefully there aren't too many people left listening to this podcast or more widely who think that climate change is not important. I suppose my curiosity was, well, what does that mean? If it is the most existential risk that we face, that ought to mean something to each of us individually. And what are we individually going to do differently in our personal lives? But also, what individually can and should we be doing in our professional lives? Because, we work in banks and building societies, which are highly leveraged organizations. We have an opportunity to have, a potentially massive impact on the climate transition. And so really that's where my interest lies in, okay, we have this existential challenge. It's very new and challenging for people to get their heads around. I think the industry and the world has made a lot of progress over the last few years, but it's still challenging. What can and should Treasury folk be doing to help their firm to finance the climate transition? Because we're going to have to do it, and the quicker we get on with it, the better, really.
Actually, that's quite a positive way to think about it, is it not? So what am I saying here is that you just mentioned you've got to help finance the transition. A lot of the time, people just seem to talk about stopping financing people. And I know that it's two sides of the same coin, you might say, but it's sort of just make sure you don't finance any fossil fuel related activities. So when you say you've got to finance the transition, that feels like a slightly more positive take than just the pure negative. Where would you say the financing has got to take place from your perspective? Is there any particular areas you think are clear, low-hanging fruit, or other areas that maybe people haven't thought about enough?
I guess there are a number of client or customer segments that you can look at. I'm thinking more probably in the corporate space right now. There are clearly firms who are involved, solely or predominantly in clean technologies, be it solar or wind or, whatever, which are going to be a key part of our climate transition. So, yes, you want to be making sure that they are getting an adequate supply of financing and risk capital. Does that mean that they are less risky and should have a supporting factor in the capital world? No, there's nothing to say that they are less risky than, a traditional oil major or something. But definitely, we want to be making sure that they are getting the financing that they require to scale up and to take risk in terms of developing new technologies. There's then, I think, firms, probably not new firms, who need to pivot or change the way that they do things to become more aligned with basically the Paris Agreement and the targets set within the Paris Climate Accord. And I think there's a key role for banks to play in working with their clients and indeed customers, retail customers, and saying, okay, the world needs to change the way it does things. We need to get aligned with the targets of the Paris Accord. Let's come up with transition plans. Let's work together. We will finance you if you have a credible transition plan. And here's, some ideas that we've got from our work. Let's work in partnership on that. So that's kind of the second category of clients. And then I guess the third one is firms which are heavily involved in, what we might call brown or dirty industries. Coking coal, oil, that kind of stuff. And, again, the world is not as simple as just saying, well, we're not going to finance those companies anymore. Because if you abruptly end your lending relationship with those companies, then those companies will fail and you won't get your money back anyway. So that's not very good business. Again, it's about working with them to help them transition and get Paris aligned. If ultimately they're unable to do so, I guess there's a question about whether they are the most important clients that you have and whether you want to debank them or not. If you don't want to debank them, then you're in the world of carbon offsets in order to ensure that, you yourself as a firm are aligned with the Paris targets. And then I suppose the final action is, well, you just say, do you know what? This firm isn't aligned with the Paris targets. They're not a massively important client for the bank, so we're going to debank them. But then the question is, well, you debank them, so you lose the assets, fine, but are you going to lose their transaction banking business, and their other deposits as well? And what impact is that going to have on your balance sheet? So I think it's very much, there are as many opportunities as there are risks around this, I guess, from a business perspective.
Do you want to highlight any areas that you would go to find out more about this kind of thing? Are there good papers that you would read, or would you point anyone in the area of certain books that you think have been really insightful in order for those that are interested to get more up to date about the sort of climate change, especially in the financing world, or just generally in the pure climate change world?
I think that GARP, the Global Association of Risk Professionals, are doing a great job in curating articles and podcasts and other material specifically around climate risk management within financial institutions. And I would point anyone to their website in terms of resources. There is some great stuff on there, which really hits home how important this is and how important the financial sector is to enabling the transition, to financing the transition. So yeah, I would head there.
Now, sort of moving away from the pure treasury again into sort of experiences from your perspective. Patricia, you're a lady in treasury. Over time, there's getting a lot more ladies, but you've been in the minority for a while. Do you want to take us through how you've seen the world of diversity around these areas? And is it getting better from your perspective, or have we got a lot more work to do?
I think there's still more work to do. I think there is plenty research which says that diverse teams perform better in terms of shareholder value and pretty much any metric than less diverse teams. I guess the challenge, though, is it's not necessarily assembling a team of diverse people. It's managing that diversity because diversity inherently means different views and therefore potentially a degree of friction and conflict that needs to be managed. So I think it's not just about tick box, okay, we've got to have, so many people assemble our team according to these diversity criteria. It's also about, well, how as managers and leaders are we going to make those more diverse teams work? And I think, when we're all super busy, the natural tendency is to recruit in your own image because it's easier. And that is a human instinct. And no matter how much, HR process we lay around that is the basic human instinct, I think. So yeah, I think there's more work to be done. What I observe is that on the training courses that I deliver, for example, the ALMA courses, the open courses, those are aimed at people probably in the first 10 years of their career, something like that. There's pretty good gender balance, I would say. Not necessarily great balance or diversity according to other indicators, but there is way more gender balance than there was if you go back 20 years or so, I would say. So a qualified tick on that metric. However, when I go and deliver assignments with the board or more senior members of firms, that diversity seems to have vanished again. I think it is still the case that as you get into the higher echelons of treasury and banks, the diversity can disappear. Not just gender diversity, but all the other types of diversity as well. So yeah, we're making progress, but I think there's more to do. One particular interest of mine, I suppose you might say, in the D&I space, has always been around LGB employees. And when I was at Standard Chartered, I was in my spare time co-chair of the UK LGBT network. I guess we have in the UK made a lot of progress on sort of gay marriage, gay a lot of other things. It's a protected characteristic within law, and with every generation that comes through, I think there's a wider social acceptance, which makes things easier. I compare that with when I started work, or indeed when I was at school, Section 28, the old Clause 28 that the Conservative government brought in the 80s, basically had the effect of eliminating any conversation about sexual orientation in schools whatsoever. It just didn't exist. There were no role models for people. There was no discussion. There was no sense that, a kid who was either very clear that they were gay or were wondering if they might be gay, there was no context within a school for them to be able to explore that, get assurance that it's okay. When I started work at the Bank of England, you have to sign the Official Secrets Act and lots of other confidentiality agreements. And one of the sort of catch-22s around that was that if you did not disclose on the vetting form that you were gay, and it was subsequently found out that you were, then you were deemed to be a security risk because you would be open to blackmail because you were not open about your being gay. But if you did disclose on the form that you were gay, then you were deemed to be a blackmail risk. And so, you were damned if you did and damned if you didn't, really. That was the world that, I started working. And it's completely different to what, hopefully people are experiencing when they're joining the world of work in 2024 in the UK. But it's not like that uniformly around the rest of the world. Sorry to say, there are still scores of mostly Commonwealth countries, many of them across Standard Chartered's footprint, where it's illegal to be gay and, in some countries, punishable by death. So what was interesting for me at Standard Chartered was, how could we work in countries where people don't enjoy the same freedoms as we do in the UK to make people's lives a little bit better? And particularly, how do you make international mobility possible, easy, attractive for gay people when, in many countries they wouldn't be able to take their, their trailing spouse? How within the HR framework can you deliver mobility, international mobility for aspiring LGBT people within the firm? So I still think there's tons more that can be done in that space. So to circle back to your original question, are we there yet? No. Should we do more? Yeah. But we've made a huge amount of progress that I've seen in the course of my career.
Oh, that's a great explanation, and thanks for being so open about it. Okay, so we're nearly getting to time. There's a few sort of slightly less technical topics that might be worth discussing. How about soft skills? We're full of being busy all the time, lots of things to do, lots of diversions in life. Any tips that you would give to anyone in order to be more efficient and effective?
I would say don't sweat the small stuff. Be very clear about, what are the things that you can change and control, or what are the things that you can influence, and focus on them, and don't spend a minute of energy on any of the other stuff. Because if you can't influence it, you can't change it, then you're just wasting your energy and other people's time, which is important as well.
And did you ever have a mentor? Who do you go to get some of the best advice?
No. And I think I probably felt the lack of it. I've been sort of assigned a mentor in the past in the way that, mentors get assigned to people. I'm not, and it never really worked for me. I think a better mentor is a relationship which develops sort of naturally, where, two people kind of get along. And I think, therefore, that, people, managers and leaders working within treasury and finance and risk sort of have a responsibility to look out for people that they might want to take under their wing and, act as an informal mentor for them. Don't wait for the program to be introduced by HR. Just find something that works.
And I suppose last but not least, if you were starting out again in the sort of finance or treasury area, what kind of skills do you think are the most important that you'd need these days? Are they still the same old skills that you might have started out with 20, 30 years ago, or would you be focusing on different areas now?
I think they're the same skills, to be honest. Somebody asked me the other day whether you need Python coding skills to work in Treasury because they'd been told that you did. And I thought that was quite funny, really. I mean, I guess, if you're in the modelling team, then there may be some call for those skills. But I think what are the key skills for Treasury? You need to be a bit numerate. You need to be able to communicate because Treasury touches everything in the bank, pretty much. So you need to be able to communicate technical issues to non-specialist people effectively. And I think the biggest thing is be curious. Just there's so much that you can see and you should see in Treasury, but you need to be curious to find it.
I couldn't agree more. I think the biggest issue for me personally being in Treasury is sometimes it's so exciting to go and speak to a new person about what they're doing, especially with money, that it can be a bit of a distraction because it's exciting. I just always mention this when I first started at Investec and I was in the central Treasury area. Whenever anyone needed to borrow money for whatever they were going to do with it, I used to ask them what it was for. So they'd come over, we need X number of millions, and then I'd ask them what it was for, and they would tell me all about it. And that was actually the best way to understand how the bank worked because you got that opportunity. Unfortunately, you do have to sort of commit a bit of time to understanding that. And sometimes that can be a little bit of a diversion from whatever you were supposed to be doing in the last 10 or 15 minutes. But I think in the longer term, that's an investment worth taking. So, Patricia, I think we'll leave it there for today. Thank you so much for your time. For anyone that's listened to Patricia, if you're sort of relatively new in the treasury space, you want to go on her Foundations of ALM course. And anyone that is thinking about anything climate change, green, and elements of social should probably go on the climate change course to find out about that. And that's a half day course that you can attend. But otherwise, Patricia, it's been an absolute pleasure, and thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Treasury Matters. We hope you enjoyed it. Look out for more episodes coming from us soon. And in the meantime, why don't you follow us on your favourite podcast app?